So what if I told you that the country that just reported this year of massive, just unstoppable economic stabilization, like a miraculous dodging of a global crisis, actually saw its economy secretly shrink by over 3%?
Oh, wow. Not
Right.
a
Or what if I told you that despite all those endless headlines screaming that, half of America has declared this total ideological war on science, the actual raw polling data shows like the exact opposite.
I mean, we are just constantly being bombarded with these absolute certainties.
Yeah.
The popular narratives were sold every single day. They're clean, they're binary, and honestly, they usually demand some level of panic.
Yeah,
Like,
exactly.
we're told AI is this overnight revolution that's going to just render human labor completely obsolete by, I don't know, next Tuesday.
Next Tuesday, yeah.
Or we're told our primary economic metric, GDP, is this toxic illusion.
And the incredible thing is, when you actually take the time to gather the source material, like when you really dig into the research, the underlying data, the literal mechanics of how these systems operate, every single one of those extreme narratives just begins to
It
unravel.
really falls apart.
Yeah. So, welcome to today's deep dive. We are super thrilled you're here with us because today we're taking on that massive, sometimes terrifying gulf between those popular sensationalized stories and the stubborn reality that's just quietly operating right beneath the surface.
Right. And really, the mission for this deep dive is to deconstruct that hype. We want to equip you, the listener, with the actual mechanics and the data so you can look past all that noise.
Totally. And we've got this incredibly eclectic stack of sources to help us do exactly that. We're going to examine an interview with Princeton computer science professor Arvind Narayanan on the real timeline of the AI revolution.
That's a fascinating one.
It really is. Then we'll dissect this economic debate between Noah Smith and J.D. Vance over the true value of gross domestic product. Plus, we've got some recent late 2025 Pew polling data on institutional trust in science. And finally, we're going super deep into the financial mechanics of China's economy to see if they, actually avoided a catastrophic crash.
Yeah, and a common thread running through all of these sources, even though they sound so different, is this tension between the narrative and the metric.
Right.
It's about what happens when the tools we use to measure reality are either misunderstood or politically weaponized or just outright manipulated.
Yeah. So let's start with probably the most pervasive narrative of them all right now, which is the AI hype.
Oh, yeah.
Because if you spend any time online or watching the news, the story is always that AI is this overnight existential revolution, right? It's going to wipe out white collar work and it's going to do it in a matter of months. But Arvind Narayanan, in his interview with Yasha Monk, he brings this highly contrarian, deeply structural framework to the whole thing.
He really does. And Narayan argues that AI is indeed a transformative technology. I mean, he readily acknowledges we're looking at something on the scale of electricity or, the Industrial Revolution.
Yeah.
But the critical distinction he makes is that AI is a normal technology.
Which is funny because normal sounds like a massive understatement for something that can, pass the bar exam or write a fully functional app in 10
Right.
seconds.
Sounds totally counterintuitive. But
Whoa.
when he says normal technology, he doesn't mean mundane. In economics and the history of tech, it just means the technology is subject to the same real-world friction, adoption hurdles, and implementation bottlenecks as every other major leap in human history.
Ah, okay.
Like the invention of the electric dynamo was world-changing, obviously, but factories didn't electrify overnight.
Right, you had to actually lay the wires.
Exactly. It took decades to physically rewire the grid, rethink the factory floor plans, train a totally new workforce. And Narayan argues that because of these structural bottlenecks, the timeline for AI's true impact on society isn't measured in months. It's going to unfold over
Okay,
decades.
so let's get into the mechanics of why that friction actually exists. Because the best example he gives is software engineering. If you just follow the logic of the hype narrative, software engineers should be the very first people out on the street, right?
Yeah.
Because AI can currently write the vast majority of boilerplate code pretty much instantly. And yet, the data shows the number of employed software engineers is actually growing, not shrinking.
Yeah, it's wild.
Yeah.
And to understand why that is, Narayan introduces this framework he calls the decide, execute, deliver sandwich.
The sandwich.
The sandwich, yeah. It's this way of mapping the cognitive workflow of almost any professional task, but it's really visible in software engineering. So the middle layer of the sandwich is execute. This is the actual translation of a concept into syntax. It's the typing. It's
Yeah.
generating the code.
Which is exactly what AI is phenomenal at doing.
Phenomenal. It compresses the time it takes to execute almost down to zero.
Yeah.
But And this is the key. That execution layer is sandwiched between two highly complex human layers.
Okay.
So the top layer is decide. This is the highly ambiguous, really messy process of figuring out what actually needs to be built in the first place.
Because clients rarely know what they actually want.
Never.
Right. They come in with a vague idea, this conflicting set of priorities, and a budget. So the engineer has to spend weeks interrogating the client, strategizing, and translating all that human ambiguity into a precise technical specification. Like, AI can't just sit in a boardroom and read the subtext of a client's hesitation.
Precisely. And then you have the bottom layer of the sandwich, which is deliver.
Oh.
Because once the code is executed, it doesn't just, you know, float in a vacuum. It has to be verified.
Tested and all that.
Yeah, it has to be tested against those original ambiguous human needs.
Yeah.
It has to integrate with a company's legacy systems, which is usually code that was written in, like, 2005 and is held together with digital duct tape.
I know that feeling.
Right. And ultimately, someone has to take actual responsibility for it when it goes live.
So if the execute meet in the middle gets compressed to near zero time, the top and bottom layers, the deciding and the delivering, those actually expand to fill the gap.
That is the mechanical reality of the job market right now. Because the execution phase is no longer the bottleneck, humans are spending exponentially more time strategizing, designing, testing, managing.
Okay, but let me push back on that for a second. If the machine is doing the heavy lifting of the execution, doesn't that inherently change our baseline value in the system?
Right.
Like, think of it like a restaurant kitchen. If AI is a massive, automated, hyper-advanced microwave that can instantly cook any dish perfectly, the fundamental value of a line cook is gone. But we still need a chef to decide the menu, to plate the food so it looks appetizing, and to taste it before it goes out to the dining room. Because if the customer gets food poisoning, they aren't going to sue the microwave, they're going to sue the chef.
That analogy perfectly captures Narayanan's point about accountability. And accountability really represents the absolute hard boundary of artificial intelligence.
Yeah.
In his framework, he uses a crane operator analogy.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah, so on a modern construction site, these massive multi-ton cranes do all the physical heavy lifting. The execution of moving steel is entirely outsourced to the machine. But there is always a human operator sitting up in that little cab.
Is that just like a legacy union rule, or is there a structural reason for the human in the cab?
No, it is entirely structural.
Yeah.
It comes down to liability and corporate governance. If a crane drops a steel beam onto a busy street, a human being has to be accountable. Our entire legal and economic system is built on human liability.
Right.
AI cannot be sent to prison. AI cannot have its professional engineering license revoked. AI can't be sued for damages in a way that satisfies corporate insurance policies.
That makes sense.
There's something inherent about human accountability that you simply cannot extract from a machine. Therefore, human accountability remains a non-negotiable boundary. We will always need the human in the cab.
So that makes the economic implication incredibly clear for people. If the execution can be automated, but the liability cannot, then the fundamental nature of scarcity in the job market shifts.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Narayan points out that once AI can do a specific task, that task is no longer a source of competitive advantage for any business. It just becomes a common capability.
Right, if everyone has it.
Yeah. If every single software firm can generate perfect code instantly, then perfect code is no longer what differentiates you from your competitor. So what becomes the highly valuable, scarce asset? It's human judgment. It's the expertise required for tasks that lack precise, machine-readable specifications.
So the messy human stuff.
The messy human stuff. And Narayanan believes that because this adoption will take decades due to the friction of legacy systems and liability laws, we are going to be in a constantly upward-adjusting equilibrium. Over a timescale of 20 to 30 years, the workforce actually has the time to adapt its skills toward that human judgment and accountability layer.
Which means for you, you know, listening to this, the narrative that you need to completely panic and reinvent your whole life by next month is just hype. We are outsourcing the heavy lifting, but our capacity to navigate ambiguity is about to become more valuable than ever. It really forces us to rethink how we assign value to human work.
It does. And if AI is forcing us to rethink how we measure the value of work, there's a massive debate happening right now that forces us to rethink how we measure the value of an entire society.
Yeah.
And this centers around gross domestic product, or GDP.
Right. And just to pause here for a second, what's fascinating about Noah Smith and J.D. Vance's debate here isn't the politics. And just as a disclaimer, We're not here to take sides on the political ideology of either of these guys. We are strictly looking at the tools they are using. We want to understand the actual mechanics of how they view GDP as a metric of progress.
Exactly. Just looking at the arguments. So the debate centers around Vance's argument that GDP is a fundamentally broken metric that masks societal decay.
Okay.
And Noah Smith analyzes this, pointing out that this intense anti-GDP rhetoric actually has its historical roots in the European left's degrowth movement, but it's recently been adopted and heavily repackaged by the American right.
Okay, so let's unpack Vance's actual critique. Why does he think the ruler is broken?
Vance makes a few arguments, and Smith actually acknowledges that one of them is highly legitimate from a pure economic standpoint. It's the problem of unobserved quality differences.
Unobserved quality, like the strawberry example from the sources.
Yeah.
That illustrates this perfectly. So if you go to a market and buy a pint of exquisite, perfectly cultivated Japanese strawberries for $6, and then you buy a pint of relatively mediocre, mass-produced American strawberries also for $6. In the eyes of GDP, those two transactions are absolutely identical.
Completely the same.
They both added $6 to the national economy. But the actual standard of living, like the human experience of eating the Japanese strawberries, is vastly higher.
Right, because GDP is entirely blind to quality if the market price remains the same. It is a quantitative measure, not a qualitative one. And Smith agrees with this limitation. But Vance extends this critique far beyond just strawberries. He argues that GDP ignores critical, non-monetized aspects of human flourishing, like unpaid domestic labor.
Like raising kids.
Exactly. If a parent chooses to stay home and spend formative time raising their children, GDP records that as zero value added to the economy. But society obviously values that deeply.
Yeah, Vance takes it a step further, too, linking this to what he calls spiritual misery. He argues that alongside our historic material abundance, our high GDP, we're seeing rising opioid deaths, declining life expectancy in certain demographics, and this epidemic of youth isolation and depression. So his conclusion is that worshiping this metric has pushed society to prioritize mindless consumption at the expense of actual flourishing.
It is a really powerful narrative, right? The GDP is a broken yardstick hiding our rot. But Noah Smith pushes back on this by examining the political utility of the narrative. Smith argues that this newfound GDP skepticism is essentially political cover.
Wait, how does attacking GDP provide political cover?
Well, because certain policies, like heavily restricting immigration or implementing broad free trade tariffs, mathematically lower a nation's GDP. They make a country poorer in aggregate.
Just on paper, it shrinks the pie.
Exactly. And Smith argues that if you want to enact those policies for cultural or national security reasons, you have to neutralize the standard economic objection, which is that will make America poorer. And the most effective way to neutralize that objection is to convince the public that the metric of wealth GDP is a toxic illusion to begin with.
Right. So if the ruler says your policy shrinks the economy, you just convince everyone the ruler is evil.
Pretty much. No. But Smith doesn't just dismiss Vance entirely. He does try to find the mechanical common ground.
He does, yeah. He concedes to Vance that a culture of intense overwork can absolutely boost GDP in the short term at the severe expense of family time and societal well-being. Smith actually points out that this mechanical reality is precisely why the center-left has historically advocated for policies like paid family leave to act as a counterweight, balancing economic output with human needs.
Right. But where Smith draws a hard factual line is on the opioid epidemic. Vance frames the opioid crisis as a symptom of a GDP-obsessed society, sort of suggesting that because selling pharmaceuticals boosts GDP, the metric essentially gave a thumbs up to the crisis.
Wow.
Yeah. And this is where Smith brings in the hard macroeconomic data. He cites a highly detailed study from the Philadelphia Federal Reserve that looked at the actual impact of the opioid epidemic on the real economy.
What did the Fed actually measure there?
They looked at the loss of prime-age workers from the labor force. When people become addicted, they stop working, they stop innovating, and they stop consuming normal goods.
Right.
The Fed found that the modest initial bump in GDP from the sale of those opioid pills was overwhelmingly dwarfed by the massive deadweight loss caused by the addiction.
From people just dropping out of the economy.
Exactly. The healthcare burdens, the destruction of local community economies, the collapse in labor force participation. The Philadelphia Fed estimated this caused trillions of dollars in real economic losses. So the opioid epidemic did not boost GDP. It aggressively ravaged the real economy.
So if they're looking at the exact same societal problems, the isolation, the tension between work and family, the devastation of opioids, It feels like they're fighting over whether the yardstick is broken when they should really be reaching for a thermometer.
Oh, that distinction between a yardstick and a thermometer is crucial, and it goes right back to how GDP was actually invented.
Yeah.
Simon Kuznets designed the concept of GDP in the 1930s. He specifically did not design it to be a thermometer for spiritual flourishing.
No, not at all.
It was built to measure aggregate industrial capacity so the U.S. government could figure out if it could physically afford to fight World War II. Kuznets intentionally left out unpaid domestic labor because it just wasn't relevant to wartime industrial output.
So it's a highly specific tool designed for a highly specific job. The danger is when any single metric is ripped from its original context and weaponized to fit a grand political narrative.
Which leads us directly into our next source. Because if we can't even agree on the validity of the metric we use to measure our economy, it raises serious questions about our trust in the institutions that actually gather the data.
Yes, absolutely. We're talking about the narrative surrounding American scientific institutions now. If you consume any media today, the overwhelming narrative is one of absolute institutional collapse.
Oh, totally. And Noah Smith explores this in another piece, focusing on the history and current state of American science. Because to understand the depth of the current narrative, you have to understand the baseline first.
Right.
The American scientific infrastructure wasn't always this massive behemoth. It was largely engineered immediately following World War II by visionary figures like Vannevar Bush, who directed the Office of Scientific Research and Development.
He's the one who wrote Science: The Endless Frontier, right? Which essentially laid the blueprint for government-funded basic research, the National Science Foundation, and the national labs.
Exactly. And for decades, that infrastructure made the U.S. the undisputed heavyweight champion of global science. But today, the narrative is one of panic on two fronts.
Okay.
The first is external. The headlines constantly point out that China, fueled by massive state investment, has actually overtaken the U.S. in terms of research spending and the sheer volume of scientific papers published.
Which sounds like we're losing the space race all over again. But Smith argues that this external threat is heavily misunderstood. Like, why is China publishing more papers not a death blow to U.S. science?
Because of the mechanics of how fundamental science actually works.
Mm.
It's largely open source. When a Chinese laboratory makes a fundamental discovery in material science or quantum mechanics, they publish it. U.S. researchers can read that paper, integrate those findings into their own models, and build upon those discoveries for free. Knowledge compounds globally. So while it's a shift in prestige, Smith views the rise of Chinese scientific output as a net benefit for American researchers who can just leverage that data.
So the real panic isn't external. The real panic is domestic. The dominant media narrative is that the Republican base in America has entirely lost faith in the scientific enterprise.
Right.
We are told that science has become completely polarized, that conservatives view scientific institutions as hostile left-wing echo chambers, and that half the country is ready to defund the entire post-WWII system.
And if you spend any time on social media, that narrative feels absolutely undeniable. But when we actually look at the raw data, the picture is fundamentally different. Smith points to polling data from the Pew Research Center from late 2025. This is recent, high-quality, scientifically conducted polling.
What do the actual numbers say?
Despite the intense, very loud political rhetoric, roughly two-thirds of Republicans still maintain a fair amount of confidence in science.
Wait, really? Two-thirds?
Two-thirds.
That is a massive, silent majority that completely contradicts the headline narrative.
It really does.
Yeah.
Furthermore, the Pew data shows that Americans overall still trust scientists significantly more than they trust the military.
Oh, wow.
And perhaps most surprisingly, Americans trust their scientists more than citizens in most other developed nations do.
Why is there such a massive disconnect then? Why does it feel like we are panicking over a ghost?
It comes down to the difference between political friction and structural reality. Smith impartially notes that there have absolutely been fierce debates about the politicization of science, particularly regarding public health policies and ideological mandates within academia.
Sure, there's real friction there.
There is. But the key synthesis is that this loud political friction did not translate into the conservative base demanding that we gut federal research funding. It did not result in half the country abandoning the belief in the scientific method. When it comes to taxpayer support for the National Institutes of Health or the Department of Energy labs, Republican support remains remarkably strong.
So the media takes a very real but narrow political debate about ideology and just inflates it into a false, catastrophic story about the death of American science. Reality is far more stable than the narrative suggests the foundation is holding.
Right. But this entire conversation relies on our ability to access independent data.
Yeah.
We can look at the Philadelphia Fed to understand the opioid crisis. We can look at Pew Research to understand polling. But what happens when you're trying to understand a system where the government entirely controls the narrative, the yardstick, and the printing press?
Oof. We have to talk about China's economy. The global narrative for the last 20 years has been that the Chinese Communist Party engineered a uniquely bulletproof economic machine. Whenever the rest of the world crashed, China somehow just powered through.
And Noah Smith does a deeply technical dive into this exact phenomenon. During the 2008 global financial crisis, and again during the 2015 Chinese stock market crash, China never recorded a single negative growth quarter. By their official numbers, the machine never stopped.
How is that even mechanically possible in an interconnected global economy?
Because of immense state-controlled stabilization. In a standard market economy, a crash happens because credit dries up. Banks get scared and they stop lending.
Right.
But in China, the government controls the banking system. When the economy weakens, Beijing simply commands the captive banks to flood the market with loans. They finance massive infrastructure projects, bridges to nowhere, high-speed rail lines, endless apartment blocks, just to keep the GDP numbers artificially high.
So it's a form of extreme credit stabilization. But that brings us to the 2010s and the most massive real estate boom in human history.
Yeah. For a decade, China fueled its GDP growth by lending astronomical sums to real estate developers. But the mechanics of this boon were incredibly fragile. Developers used a pre-sale model, meaning citizens were paying mortgages on apartments that hadn't even been built yet.
Oh my God.
And the developers then used that cash to buy more land rather than finishing the buildings.
A massive structural Ponzi scheme. And the Chinese government finally tried to rein it in with a policy called the Three Red Lines, which basically restricted how much debt these developers could take on.
And that policy was the pin that popped the bubble. It started in late 2021 with the spectacular default of Evergrande, one of the largest developers in the world. This triggered a cascading domino effect of bankruptcies across the sector. Property prices began falling, consumer confidence just vanished, and the construction sector ground to a halt.
And real estate and related sectors made up nearly 30% of China's entire economy. A crash of that magnitude should have cratered their GDP.
It absolutely should have. But the narrative that emerged globally was, China's done it again. The official story was that they simply opened their old playbook, directed their captive banking system to pivot away from real estate, and started lending heavily to the manufacturing sector instead. Officially, Beijing proclaimed the economy was stable and there was no crash.
But Smith argues that the crash absolutely did happen. It was just deliberately hidden. So when the government controls the official GDP numbers, how do you see through the fog?
You have to look at the secondary indicators where the seams are bursting. And the most glaring evidence was the labor market. As the real estate sector imploded, youth unemployment in China skyrocketed to catastrophic levels. It became so undeniably high that the Chinese government physically changed how they measure reality. In the summer of 2023, they simply suspended the release of youth unemployment data entirely.
Wait, they just stopped publishing it?
Yes. And when they finally brought the data back months later, they had fundamentally modified the methodology to use a much narrower definition of unemployment, artificially lowering the number.
It sounds exactly like putting a piece of black tape over the check engine light on your dashboard. Like, the engine, the job market is audibly knocking, but you've just decided not to look at the warning light.
It is exactly that. And
yeah.
Even with that revised, manipulated methodology, the unemployment trend was still visibly grim. Smith points out that we can also look at alternative indicators that are much harder for the central government to fake. One of those is the Purchasing Managers Index, or PMI.
Right. What exactly is the PMI and why is it reliable?
Well, the PMI is based on direct surveys of supply chain managers and purchasing executives at thousands of companies. It asks them simple binary questions. Are you ordering more raw materials this month than last month? Are you hiring more people or firing people?
Oh, I see.
Because it's a decentralized survey of actual business activity, rather than a top-down government calculation, it is much harder to fudge. And the employment sub-index of the non-manufacturing PMI showed severe, prolonged contraction. The labor market was in deep distress.
Okay, so the secondary indicators show a crash. But what about the top-line GDP number? Did Beijing ever actually admit to a contraction?
They did, but you have to know how to translate their numbers. China officially reported that its economy shrank by 0.8% quarter on quarter in the second quarter of 2022.
I mean, 0.8% doesn't sound catastrophic.
It doesn't until you realize that in the United States, we annualize our GDP numbers. We measure how much the economy would shrink if that pace continued for a full year. By standard U.S. accounting, that 0.8% drop equates to an annualized contraction of over negative 3%.
Wow, negative 3% is a deep, highly destructive recession.
It is. And here is the most shocking detail. That 0.8% official figure was actually revised down from an initially reported negative 9.3%.
So they saw the raw data coming in at negative 9.3, panicked, and just smoothed it out to look like a minor dip.
Exactly. Smith relies on several independent, external analyses to prove this history of chronic data manipulation. He cites a landmark 2016 study by Nakamura and colleagues. These researchers bypassed the official government top-line numbers entirely and built a model using detailed, localized Chinese consumption data.
That's brilliant. What did they find?
They found that the Chinese government chronically smoothed its data in both directions.
Both directions?
Yeah. So in boom years, they fudged the numbers downward so the growth doesn't look unsustainably hot and trigger inflation fears. And in bad years, they fudged them upward so it doesn't look like a crash. Nakamura's model estimated that China's growth actually dipped into negative territory back in 2007 and 2008, despite the official narrative of endless unbroken growth.
Unbelievable. And what about independent data on the current Evergrande crash?
The Rhodium Group, which is a highly respected independent research firm that tracks bottom-up data in China, did a similar analysis for the recent crisis. They estimated that China's economy absolutely shrank in 2022 and grew much, much more slowly in 2023 than the official numbers claim.
Which makes sense.
If you think about the reality on the ground, strict, brutal COVID lockdowns, a collapsing property sector, massive youth unemployment, and falling retail sales, the idea that their economy was steadily growing at 5% through all of that is a mathematical fiction.
So the narrative that they dodged the bullet is just the result of a manipulated yardstick. But what is the long-term macroeconomic cost of this? If you just hide the crash by forcing state-owned banks to roll over bad debt and pump endless loans into manufacturing, eventually the system has to pay the price, right?
Oh, absolutely. The cost is profound. Structural economic inefficiency. By refusing to let the real estate market naturally clear out the bad debt, by not allowing developers to fail and liquidate, and by instead forcing capital into manufacturing just to keep factories running and employment numbers up, China is misallocating capital on a historic scale.
They're building things the market doesn't actually want just to keep the GDP metric looking healthy.
Exactly. This creates a massive overhang of what economists call zombie companies. These are unproductive firms that do not make a profit and only continue to exist because the state-controlled banks keep pumping them with artificial credit, rolling over their loans at suppressed interest rates.
Oh, and that just kills productivity growth.
It suffocates the economy from the inside out. They avoided the sharp, terrifying pain of a visible crash, but they traded it for a chronic, debilitating economic illness that their own manipulated metrics refused to diagnose. Japan went through a very similar process in the 1990s, leading to decades of lost growth. China is risking the exact same fate because they prioritized the narrative of stability over the reality of the market.
Man. We have covered an immense amount of ground today, and the mechanical depth of these sources is just staggering. From the layers of a software engineer's coding workflow, to the 1930s origins of the GDP yardstick, to the raw polling data on scientific trust, to the hidden financial engineering and zombie companies of China.
It's a lot, yeah.
Sure.
But when we pull all of this together, a very clear, highly relevant lesson emerges for anyone trying to understand the modern world. Across every single one of these realms, there is a profound, fundamental difference between the sensational stories we were told and the quiet, stubborn data operating beneath them.
The popular narrative wants you to panic about AI stealing your job tomorrow. But the structural reality says that because of friction, liability, and the need for human judgment, you actually have decades to adapt your skills to become the crane operator.
Right. The narrative says GDP is either a flawless measure of our triumph or a toxic lie destroying our souls. But the historical reality is that it's just a highly specific industrial tool designed for a specific wartime job. And we shouldn't ask a yardstick to measure the temperature of our spiritual flourishing.
The narrative says half of America has declared total war on the scientific enterprise. But the raw polling data shows that the vast majority of people still quietly trust the institution, even if the political friction on the surface is incredibly loud.
And the global narrative says China is an invincible economic machine that defies the laws of financial gravity. But the mechanical reality is that they suffered a severe crash, and they're currently masking it by manipulating their own dashboard and misallocating capital.
So for you, listening right now, the takeaway here is immense empowerment. You do not have to be swept up in the panic. You don't have to be a victim of the hype cycle. By taking the time to understand the actual mechanics, whether it's the decide, execute, deliver sandwich, the methodologies of state statistics, or the difference between political noise and base funding reality, you can navigate this incredibly complex world with clarity.
It is entirely about demanding to understand the machinery, not just reading the output. When a headline screams an absolute certainty at you, you now have the conceptual tools to pause, look past the noise, and ask the most important question. What is the ruler we are using and who is holding it?
And that leaves us with one final, I think, incredibly provocative thought to mull over as we wrap up today. If Arvind Narayan is right, and AI is slowly shifting humans into the role of the crane operators, the ones who simply decide what to build and how to measure success while the machine handles the execution, and if we've just seen across economics and state statistics how easily our current human metrics can be manipulated, weaponized, and fudged by narratives,
how on earth will we decide what metrics to program into the artificial intelligence of the future?
Exactly. If the machine is ultimately going to optimize for whatever goals we set for it, how do we ensure it actually measures and pursues true human progress when we clearly can barely agree on what that looks like ourselves? We are handing the ultimate execution engine a set of profoundly broken yardsticks.
It is the ultimate alignment problem, and it requires us to fix our own metrics before we hand them over to the machine.
Yeah, the waters of our societal diagnostics are incredibly muddy right now. But hopefully today we've given you a much better flashlight to see through the fog. Thank you so much for taking the time to join us on this deep dive. We will catch you next time.